And welcome to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate, listeners. I am one of the hosts of this show, Trace.
And I am the other host, Julian. I like how our show title sounded like, Please Elaborate, listeners. As in like, this one's going to be on you all. We're going to kick
back. We're going to reverse the polarity.
Oh no, the temporal field.
If you haven't listened to this show before, Julian and I get together and we answer questions submitted by each other or by our listeners or sometimes by our guests. And those questions are sometimes absurd. And we do the actual science research to figure out what the answer might be.
They're at a minimum absurd. Like we don't accept well thought out, simple to answer questions. We demand absurdity from you and from each other.
And honestly, the audience delivers.
They deliver.
They really do.
They've been delivering in spades lately. We've been getting a lot of questions come in. We have it linked to our, you know, like insider little Slack channel. And for the last few days, it's just been like, ba-bing, ba-bing, ba-bing.
Oh, yeah.
It was hard for me to pick for this episode. It was really difficult.
I'm excited.
Some good ones.
Yeah, there were so many good ones. I'm like excited for this episode, like every time we record, but I'm also excited for the future episodes because I keep seeing these new questions come in and I'm super pumped about them.
Yeah.
I'm just really proud of our audience for submitting cool stuff. So thanks, y'all. That's really awesome. If you all want to submit a question now, you can go down into the show notes, go to our website, whatever, go to thatsabsurdshow.com/ask, or you know, you can always email us as well a question.
There's many, many avenues to reach us with your absurd inquiries. So, Trace, who's kicking it off this episode?
You went last episode with Ralph. I think you should go first this time because I don't want you to go last. I want you to go first. You're the best.
Oh, that's very sweet. But that means technically I have less of a break. You know, I have I'm like an athlete playing back to back games, except I'm like a brain leet, like a mind leet.
Brathlete.
A brathlete. That just sounds like
a cerebellumist. That sounds bad. Let's not do that one. You're not, not that one.
That's a disease for sure. that I do not want to contract, which is an excellent segue into my question from this week. So this comes from Nitai, and Nitai asks, if you went back in time to see the dinosaurs, would they go extinct from the common cold?
Ooh, interesting. Very War of the Worlds kind of a question.
That's where I went too. That was actually my first instinct. I don't know why, but I think about the ending of War of the Worlds, especially like the 2005 one with Tom Cruise, a lot.
Wait,
like,
are you saying War of the Worlds is your Roman Empire?
Sometimes, you ever just think about War of the Worlds?
You ever just think about War of the Worlds?
You ever just...
just yes. Like in general.
Just, you know, just sitting there.
I honestly think about War of the Worlds way more often than I probably should.
I do a lot because, you know, the ending of it and the original one from, you know, what was it, the 30s with Orson Welles was like, oh no, this alien species with superior technology has invaded us. And oh gosh, they're destroying us. Oh, but hey, really good news. A bunch of pathogens wiped them out. Like they forgot about the pathogens. And so we win, everybody. Good job. Good. All that military spending didn't actually factor into it. It was little microbes that
it was just
these
life.
Advanced beings
life,
forgot to account for.
Finds a way.
Yeah, to kick some alien three-toed booty.
Apparently, aliens didn't have mRNA technology yet.
I guess not. Which brings up many good points that we will actually probably get to, but I think it's funny in War of the Worlds, though, how instantaneous it is.
Yeah.
Like, in the 2005 version, I watched the ending again just to, like, see if it was as silly as I remember, and yeah, like, they take down one of these alien, like, giant battle machines, and then, like, the containing little goose sack that the alien pilot is in like bursts open and it comes out and it's like all menacing and like growling at the soldiers, and then it just like becomes all crusted over and dies like immediately. And then Morgan Freeman's narration is just like, looks like those super genius aliens forgot about God's humblest creatures, bacteria. And that's like the end of the movie. And you're like,
honestly,
oh.
It was a pretty good Morgan Freeman. Like, I could hear it. So. I could hear it. Maybe it wasn't a good impression of Morgan Freeman, but when you were talking, I could hear Morgan Freeman in the background.
It was more about the spirit than the, you know, vocal timbre and quality, right? It was the gravitas.
Andy Dufresne was a friend of mine.
I wanted them to know that Red had been here, too. No, so...
Anyway,
a lot of people praying to me, Bruce. We're just gonna do all of Morgan Freeman's roles,
his whole catalog.
We're gonna take a slight 3-hour diversion to just welcome do Morgan Freeman impersonation.
Welcome to Free Chat, the Freedom Morgan Freeman podcast. All Morgan Freeman, all the time.
All the time. That's what it reminded me of, and then we followed up with Nitai to ask if he wanted to elaborate, and he actually included something that I'd forgotten, which was The Simpsons had this exact gag in like a Treehouse of Horror episode called Time and Punishment, where like Homer goes back in time and he keeps messing things up, and in one instance, like a dinosaur is about to eat him and he sneezes on it, and then the dinosaur backs away and like sniffles, sneezes, and it's just like this literal domino effect of like every dinosaur in the land. Yeah, just dropping out of the sky. And the pterosaurs, which are technically not dinosaurs, so I'll include them too. I remember them them plummeting to the earth. So yeah, it's a great question, right? And I think now that we're in kind of cold season where we're all indoors from the winter and people are getting sniffly and diseases are spreading, you might wonder what is your chance if you were to hop in a time machine right now and go back 65 million plus years that you would also be responsible for wiping out the dinosaurs. So I did some digging, and one thing I wanted to clear up right away, because Nitai in his deeper explanation of his question says, well, you know, they didn't have this adaptation to modern day pathogens like we do, would it cause this extinction event? And the immune system is adaptive, which is a really amazing thing, but we don't only rely on an adaptive immune system. So yeah, everybody kind of knows about the, oh, you'll be exposed to some pathogen and your body creates cells that have a memory of what this pathogen is. And then the next time it sees it, it can attack it and kill it, right? And that's like the premise for how vaccines work or why you can get inoculated after exposure to a certain disease, right?
Right.
Well, we don't only rely on that, which is called acquired immunity. We also have innate immunity, which is a much more generalized approach to fighting off pathogenic invaders like viruses, bacteria, fungi, parasites, that sort of thing.
Okay.
So you probably know of white blood cells being one of the parts of your immune system that fights off these infection. And it's true that these white blood cells, also known as leukocytes, they can become specialized to recognizing certain pathogens. But the most common white blood cells that you have in your immune system are actually called...
Are you pulling out a textbook?
I am. I have my wife's so biology textbook because I wanted to make sure I got this right. Don't clown me like that. Don't out me to the listeners.
No, pull out that textbook. Get it.
No, so the most common leukocytes are called neutrophils. And these are actually white blood cells that aren't specialized for anything. They just are programmed to kind of recognize the general features of invaders, like viruses or infected cells or cancerous cells, and attack and kill those. So even without like adaptive immunity, you could bet that, you know, traveling back in time, these dinosaurs are still going to have this innate immunity, because innate immunity has been around a lot longer than dinosaurs. And in fact, so has the ability to have adaptive immunity.
Oh, I didn't know that. I was going to ask how we know, or we're pretty confident that dinosaurs had these abilities, even in general. I mean, I assume they did, but...
Yes. So we're, even though, you know, fossil records are not the soft tissues, right? So that's kind of hard to get a feel for. It's all like the bones that have been fossilized. We can still tell from, you know, like evolutionary trees and DNA that we've, you know, mapped out and looked back into the past when different features of the immune system came about. And it turns out that the adaptive immunity that you think of when you think of your immune system, that's been around for probably about 500 million years.
Oh, wow. That's a minute.
That's a long time, right? So that's basically when jawless fishes split off from jawed vertebrates and jawed fishes. And it seems to, evidence points to adaptive immunity coming around about that time.
Hmm.
So, that's, you know, even if we could transmit some disease to said dinosaurs, like the common cold, they still have innate immunity to fight it off and an adaptive immune system to recognize the pathogen and maybe inoculate it from future infections. So there's no guarantee that just because we're introducing some modern virus that it's going to play havoc with the dinosaur.
Right.
Yeah, makes sense, right?
I mean, it makes sense, yeah. You would go back in time, and like when you go travel anywhere in the world, an isolated nation, you do think about, oh, well, I'm bringing a disease that's going to kill the things that are here. But we're all also humans. There's a lot of human diseases. Does that come into play? Am I jumping ahead of your narrative here?
You're actually right on it. Now that I have my wife's textbook open, I have to correct myself. It's acquired immunity, not adaptive immunity.
Oh, okay, got
right.
it.
So that's even what you...
It's adapting, but it's not. That's not what it's called.
Yeah, you're acquiring that immunity. And you can right. pass on this acquired immunity to your offspring, too, which is a nice feature.
Oh, that's a nice bonus. Aww. Yeah, good feature of that.
Thanks, genetics. Okay, so an issue, though, with this question specifically is... Nitai asks, would we kill them with the common cold? And a thing you have to take into account with viruses is what's known as their host range, right? Mm. Like, diseases can and do jump between species. I mean, coronavirus yeah.
right.
is a pretty recent yeah. and poignant reminder of that, right?
If you went to the zoo during, to your local zoological park during the coronavirus, because it was a nice outdoor activity that one could do when we were all supposed to be isolated and not necessarily, you know, and physically distanced from each other, there were several animals that had big barriers here in the LA Zoo. They were like, do not go near these animals because, mm-hmm. And they had even taken some of them out of the exhibits because it was transmissible to them. So they could right. have gotten COVID from the human visitors.
Question for you, though. Did these animals have a common thread? Is there something about these animals that was similar?
Yeah, I think they were all mammals. I'm pretty
sure.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they were all fuzzy. Probably, you know, had some milk bearing structures in order to provide that,
yeah.
and then probably birthed live young, you know.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
things that make us mammals.
Unless they're platypuses.
Yeah.
Did they have the platypi locked away?
I didn't see one.
Anyway, yeah. But yeah, you hit the nail on the head, right? These animals that zoologists were concerned for their safety during the coronavirus pandemic were mammals, because it's easier for viruses to jump between more closely related species because they're going to share similar features that allow these viruses to operate, mm-hmm. right? So the common cold in humans is caused by different rhinovirus strains. And rhinoviruses that cause the common cold are adapted only for humans. They just go after us. I mean, dogs, cats, they can all get different rhinoviruses of their own.
Which are separate from ours.
But yeah, but they don't cross. The host range for rhinovirus is really, really narrow. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's
cool.
Pretty cool. So you don't really have to worry about transmitting the common cold to something as distantly related to us as dinosaurs. And it's actually kind of interesting because viruses operate by sort of, you know, exploiting some weakness in how your cells operate, right? Like a virus is technically a non-living thing. It's a little package of DNA or RNA in a little protein capsid. And then that capsid, if it's attacking a eukaryote like us, will have a outer sheath made of, you know, cell membrane material, and then little proteins on it. And those proteins are kind of like a key that unlock specific, like, keyholes in our cells. And the rhinovirus receptors for us, they attack things in our respiratory tract known as intercellular adhesion molecule 1. That's the primary way that they get it.
Wow.
So jeez. This adhesion molecule is actually part of how your immune system works.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's a little, like, molecule sticking out of cells that you have in different parts of your body, like the endothelium, which is, like, the coating on the outside of your respiratory tract that's in touch with, you know, the air that goes by.
Got it. I hope and it's the inside of your respiratory tract.
Yeah, it's inside your body,
yeah,
but the outside...
The outside...
If you think of your mouth as like a tube, right?
Right.
And like
yeah.
the inside
that
of
is
the tube.
That is the outside because it continues from the out, it goes around my into the butt.
Like you could shove like your whole mouth in there continuously, you know. And so anything that your hand would slide by, this is a really gross kind of way of visualizing
it. It's very
it.
Gross to think about. Very Jonah and the whale kind of Pinocchio and the whale. Lots of whale.
Right.
Interiors that we've seen.
So those are your endothelial cells, and in your respiratory tract they have these adhesion molecules that
Han Solo and the space whale.
Is that, I didn't read that book of the Bible. I don't know that one. Okay.
Sorry.
Oh, no, that was offensive. Okay, so these cells have these adhesion molecules because they allow your white blood cells to actually grab onto and kind of locomote around. That's how your white blood cells can't swim. They've got to grab onto these adhesion molecules and kind of ladder their way around like a little amoeba. And the rhinoviruses, by and large, that give us the common cold, the way that they get inside these cells in your respiratory tract is they latch onto that molecule and then open up the cell and kind of like inject themselves inside. And then the cell's machinery copies the RNA of the rhinovirus and makes a whole bunch of copies and, you know, causes an infection. But it's only adapted for us, for our specific respiratory tract and the proteins on it. So the host range is super, super narrow. But that's not to say I wouldn't be worried about all diseases.
What diseases?
Okay, think about this. Can you name any current living dinosaurs?
Crocodiles.
No, crocodilians are cousins, but they are not dinosaurs.
Chickens.
There you go. You
act delicious chickens.
Delicious, delicious chickens. Chickens and birds are dinosaurs. There's no other way of putting it. They just are.
They just are.
I got in a big argument recently with an entire class of community college students over whether or not birds are reptiles. And I'm here to tell you, yes, birds are reptiles. They're dinosaurs. And dinosaurs are reptiles.
Wow.
So birds and humans do have some diseases that can be passed back and forth, like bird flu.
Avian flu.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right? It's rare. You really have to be in super close contact with birds and all the waste products that they give off, you know, like their feces or from like their little nasal glands or whatever, that carries a lot of these avian-borne diseases like viruses and bacteria. But there is documented examples of transmission between people and birds.
Yeah.
And it's possible, if you were to have this time machine and go back in time and see dinosaurs and you were infected with avian flu, you could give it to the dinosaurs, because birds are just dinosaurs. So there's going to be a decent chance that the way their body works is still able to be exploited by avian flu.
Whoa, that would be so sad.
Yeah. It would be. I actually looked up that Simpsons episode ending as well, and the comments were like, oh, this could totally happen because of what happened when European explorers first came to the New World, right?
Right.
And that's not a perfect analogy, because when Europeans came over to the New World, they weren't running into dinosaurs. They were running into people.
Other people.
Other people.
Other human beings.
Right. And these people that they were running into did not have a history of domesticating animals and living with livestock in such close contact as Europeans and Eurasians have, right? Europeans had been farming cattle and chickens for a long, long, long time. And so the viruses and diseases of these animals and the humans had way more opportunities to cross over and infect each other.
Yeah.
So when these Europeans came to the New World and they brought smallpox with them, the humans in North America and South America, they had no resistance to it because they just didn't have this close contact with livestock like that.
And they didn't spend a lot of time with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the opportunity for that cross-species jump also has to be there. If you're going back in time with bird flu for some reason, like you're like, I've just got a little bird flu, but let me just hop in the old time machine real quick, take this baby for a spin.
Yeah.
You're probably still not going to infect the dinosaurs unless you're like constantly hanging around them and sneezing on them and stuff.
Right.
Pooping in their drinking water. Like it's probably going to be okay. But what you shouldn't do is bring chickens back with you.
Yeah, probably not.
Like, don't, if you are going back to see the dinosaurs, leave your chickens at home.
That seems like a good moral of any time travel story.
I think that's a thing to live by. What I would be more concerned with, though, what if you infect early mammals?
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
There you go.
What if I go back in time and I'm a mammal and there are mammals there, I could get them sick and then I don't exist. And now we've got a paradox, which is not good.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants that because exactly. Then, you know, alternate timelines and, oh, man,
exactly.
It gets complicated.
So, Nitai's question, he asked, like, oh, what if we were the cause of the mass extinction time travel paradox? And I'm like, I wouldn't be worried about the dinosaurs. I'd be worried about us.
Yeah. You could kill ancient mammals.
Yeah.
With diseases that they aren't prepared to protect mm-hmm. themselves against, but, even something as simple as the common cold.
Yeah, but they're still vulnerable to, because they share, you know, a lot of the same functions and structures that mammals have in common with each other. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we like to think of 65 million years or 150 million years, you know, the dinosaurs were around a long time, as a long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it was relative to us, but not necessarily relative to life existing or Earth being around with life on it. You know, 50 million years is not that much. It's a lot for modern humans, but not for life.
Yeah. So. And another thing to keep in mind with evolution is that if there's no reason for things to change, system structures, like if it's working, then it doesn't change very much. So you could go back all that way and still have things very much in common with ancient mammals, you know, that therefore would provide an in for these pathogens to attack.
Yeah.
Something to think about.
I think that's something you should think about every time you watch a time travel show. Is like, you know, Marty McFly's taking diseases from the 1980s back to the 1880s. You know, that might not be good.
Yeah.
He could go and kill everybody in that town.
In particular, right, like the Spanish flu pandemic from like 1917, 1918, you know,
yeah.
that he's probably immune to. But that, yeah, it could be devastating, right?
If he had influenza,
yeah.
Like a really bad influenza, that could kill. You basically are starting a Doc Brown's inadvertent time travel to 1885 could have kicked off what later became the Spanish
yeah.
flu.
Yeah, this is heavy, Doc.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Something wrong with the gravitational pull?
Polarity.
Such a good response. Such a good response.
Yeah, exactly. So I love this question. I think the concerns are well-placed, but the specifics of it, I'm like, dinosaurs, probably going to...
They'll be fine.
Probably going to be okay.
They're going to be fine.
Leave the chickens at home, and that's it.
Just don't bring a chicken when you time travel. That is the thing we want you to take away from this
yeah,
episode.
Yeah, we're going
to
get a t-shirt with that. Don't bring a chicken when you time travel.
Don't bring a chicken when you time travel. Leave it at home.
Remember.
Leave your chicken at home. Bring a towel. Don't bring a chicken.
Can you imagine the time machine, like, portal has, like, a big no chickens
No
sign?
Chickens. Don't take a chicken.
No chickens.
No chickens.
That would be so funny. Oh, my gosh.
That's
things
great.
You don't think about.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned a bunch of biology, because I'm going to talk about a bunch of biology and my answer as
oh,
well.
Oh, good.
But first, let's have a quick break. Hello. Maybe we're back from an advert. Maybe we didn't have one. Either way, thanks for listening to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. How's it going?
Are you asking me or the...
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because I can't hear the audience. Maybe they're in their car or wherever going like, I'm doing great, and I hope that's the
case.
Hold
on, let's give them a pause for that. Hey, how you doing? That's good. That's good. I'm glad
yeah,
to hear
that's
it.
Awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Oh, man. Wow. Yeah, me too. Me
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I assume people are talking while you're talking when you're just saying things that are like filler words. Like, yeah, 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 totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Cool. Well, I'm doing well. I'm back. I just had a bathroom break, so I feel
oh,
better.
Wonderful. That segues well to my question.
Did it?
It did. So my question is something that when I saw come through in our little Slack that you mentioned earlier, I was so excited. And I was so excited for a very specific reason. I'm not going to actually tell you what the question is yet, because I have a pre-question for you, Julian.
Yeah.
Did you listen to Weird Al Yankovic growing up?
I mean, I am the way I am. Obviously, I did.
I assumed you did, but I didn't want to, you know, I can't assume everybody was like me.
There's a 100% chance that anybody who forms a science jokey podcast did in fact listen to Weird Al.
Thank you, Weird Al, for all that you have done for
us. That Venn diagram's a perfect circle.
Maybe you remember the 1993 album Alapalooza, where it was like the Jurassic Park parody album, opened with a Jurassic Park song that was a parody, came out in 1993. Mm-hmm. On that, there were a bunch of different songs that maybe you recall. Jurassic Park, of course, was nominated for a Grammy, the claymation video of Weird Al's Jurassic Park video. Go watch it. It's great.
Wow.
Also on that album was the Flintstones meets Red Hot Chili Peppers parody called Bedrock Anthem. Yabba dabba, yabba dabba dabba do
oh,
now.
Classic.
You know, that one, yeah. Achy Breaky Song, parody of Miley Cyrus's less successful dad. And then, of course,
whatever his name is, can't be bothered to look it up.
Doesn't matter. Then there's Bohemian Polka, the polka version of Bohemian Rhapsody. Of course, Living in the Fridge, which was... parody of an Aerosmith song. He was just peaking in the 90s.
We're transitioning from a Morgan Freeman fan podcast to an all Weird Al Yankovic nostalgia podcast.
Honestly, I'd be here
totally
for that.
Fine.
Let's go through every single song in his discography and talk about it.
No complaints.
So also on this album is one of the lesser known songs, which is a style parody. Interestingly, different than a direct parody. Direct parody is like White and Nerdy, mm-hmm. right? It's a direct parody. We took the song, rewrote the lyrics. A style parody is like, it's a different song. It feels a little different, but it sounds really similar. This one is Traffic Jam, which is actually, it's a parody of Let's Go Crazy by Prince and the Revolution, but he's sitting in a traffic jam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In that song, there is a lyric. I swear this all makes sense.
This is the longest walk ever to a question.
It really is. It really is. My back teeth are floating and my nerves are shot and I'm stuck right here in the middle of a traffic jam. And that is the first thing I thought of when I heard this question from Spencer. Mm-hmm. Is that sad that I thought of a 1993 Weird Al song when I saw this question and said, now I have to answer it?
It just shows how clearly, like, hardwired your brain is around Weird Al Yankovic as formative experiences. Because that was instant recall, apparently.
It was. And I remembered that lyric but I still double-checked it to make sure that it was right.
let me zoom in on this Prince-style parody, because famously, Prince never gave Weird Al permission to parody any of his songs. So he had to rely on a style parody.
So Spencer asked, why do my teeth feel like they're floating or vibrating when I have to go to the bathroom? It's a great question. And Spencer gave some interesting and additional context. I've experienced this when I'm close to a toilet with an urgent need, but my body knows it's not quite time to unload. For example, maybe there is a line or the belt won't unlatch in time. I've asked a few doctor friends and it turns out it's not really known in the medical world. Spencer, this is a great question. You are not alone. Apparently Weird Al Yankovic also knows what this is.
See, I always thought this was just an expression.
Yeah.
Like, I have never experienced the sensation of my teeth floating. And I'm sorry if this is graphic and gross, but I imagined it as your bladder is so full that your entire human body is a vessel for urea, let's say. And at this point, the levels of this nitrogenous liquid have reached your molars in the back of your mouth.
Which are now floating because molars somehow float.
They're only loosely tethered to your gums, right? And as soon as the liquid level rises, like a little buoy, and that's how you know you have to pee. That's what I assume expression.
Yeah. Honestly, you're right on. I have done a lot of desktop research on this because I had also heard of this phrase, but I do not experience this sensation. So I was like, is this phrase just a phrase? You know, like one of the other many phrases for going to the bathroom that are so weird and not at all connected to the actual act of going to the bathroom. And it is, but it is also not. So I'm glad that you have heard of it. I was going to ask, but lots of people describe it as an itchy, tickly, or sometimes even like a painful or pressure feeling in the gums or the teeth.
Seriously?
When holding urine. Yeah.
Okay.
I know. It's a real sensation that people have. It's not just like, oh, I really got to go. It's, you know, a real feeling that they're having in their face, inside of their mouth. And there are people on all these forums across the internet saying that they think it's totally normal and that their family has this and they experience it. And some people are saying they're crazy and maybe they should stop doing various drugs that they decided were the bad ones. And either way, I'm not a doctor, but the fact that I could find so many examples of this makes me think that it's probably totally normal. It's just that it might be because some people mention their family members having it. Maybe it's genetic. It's just wild that a lot of people had never even heard of it, which means they should listen to more Weird Al Yankovic, I think. Anyway, this is just a basic reminder that people experience the world differently from you, and you should be open to that. So you had heard of the phrase, and I had as well. So that's where I started with my research. I started with a little history, like I do. So back teeth are floating is a informal or vulgar in some dictionaries way to say you need to pee. There are a variety of different ways to say that you need to pee.
Are we going to rank them in most polite to least polite? Because I already know the most polite, which is how my grandmother says it.
Oh, I need to
which
know.
Which is, I have to tinkle.
I have to tinkle. Then,
which
oh, I
is
love that she says tinkle.
My favorite way of saying it.
I like having to visit the little whatever's room.
No,
you know when
I do not like
used to
that.
Work at a museum.
I do not
we
like
were
that
in
at all.
Costume, and we were in like a full costume of an 1880s soldier. So I would always be like, "We'll be right back. We just have to go visit the little soldier's room," which I thought was really fun.
That is cute. But can you imagine an 1880s soldier at a fort going, "Just a moment, I have to tinkle."
You're right. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good.
The phrase doesn't seem to have a specific point when it was invented that I could find. It seems to be associated with the American South, which makes sense because it didn't actually originate there, I don't think. I found an example of voir les dents du fond qui baigne, which means literally my back teeth are floating.
That sounded cool. Is that from like Louisiana, though?
So if it's associated with the American South, but it shows up in French slang books, which it does, I would guess, yes, the same, that it probably came in through Louisiana into the South. So that's why we hear it, or it's associated on most of these forums, like, oh, I think this is from the South. You know, we said this, blah, blah, blah. And I bet you it came out of French, was directly translated from French through that part of the country, and then just became part of the culture in the South. However, if you go into France, I've translated a bunch of French websites and was reading through those, and they use this to mean that you're very full, that like you just overindulged in a meal. You're super duper full. Your like teeth still have like food in between them and stuff. So your teeth are like swimming in matter. So it's like not a polite way to say that your back teeth are floating. It also could mean that you're like gonna throw up. You're so full.
You know,
full.
If you're Bear Grylls, you could use this expression either way. Does the internet still make those jokes about Bear Grylls and how he always the survivalist and how in nature to get fluids he drinks his own? You know what? Never mind. That was a funny joke 5 years ago. We're gonna move on.
It was pretty gross to think about.
Yeah. Well, don't take it out with me. That's Bear Grylls. I don't advocate for drinking urine at all. That's
I'm
a
not
going to
take it up with Bear Grylls. He would. I feel like he would punch me.
Probably.
Bow, bow, bow. And then
right
I would be like, ouch.
Gets a nice, refreshing. You know what? Not going to keep making the joke.
I'm just going to say, I have to tinkle. And he would say, I am thirsty. Thank you. So that whole kind of history is what I could find. It was a little bit of a breakthrough when I found that there were French people talking about this phrase, and Americans or people who had lived in America were jumping into the comments in French saying like, oh, in the US they use this to mean that they have to go to the bathroom, which I thought was really interesting. And it would make sense that you would, you know, drink a lot of wine or a lot of beer or whatever, eat a lot of food, and then it could easily jump from one place to another. So here's what I got that the floating is not. Mm-hmm. Your grandmother saying I have to tinkle is probably not going to trigger this back teeth are floating thing. Most people seem to talk about it when they really have to go. Even Spencer mentions it, like it's an urgent need and you cannot go yet. You're waiting in line or you like aren't getting your pants undone fast enough and you feel this weird feeling. So tinkling, whizzing, having a leak, you know, whatever other euphemism you're going to use, probably not applying to back teeth are floating. That's more like you have to go really bad. So for that, I wanted to know a little bit more about how we pee, because it started to give me this idea that I might have figured this out. I am not going to write a paper on it because I don't have time. But if there is a doctor out there who wants to do the research, I will talk to them about it. And it'll be really interesting. So if you have to pee by the way, right now you should probably just go pee, because we're going to talk about pee a lot for the next few minutes.
So bad for the people listening to this in the car that can't get, like, they're stuck in traffic. Oh man.
Yeah, maybe switch. Oh, maybe switch episodes. Come
it's
back.
It's just like the Weird Al song. Only we're causing it.
So. All humans have to pee at some point. There are organs, whether your organs are inside or outside or somewhere in between, you're going to ingest some food and water and you're going to pee. Solid waste goes out the back into the alley. Liquid waste comes out the front. Kidneys process the liquid waste. They dump it into the bladder through tubes called ureters, which is pretty awesome. And then the bladder holds onto it until it's excreted. Do you have any idea how much pee you could make in a day, Julian?
Is this like a challenge?
Well, I mean, yeah, if you want to go
like,
for that.
Like, if I were going for a personal best, are we talking, like, average?
Do you have a personal best?
Yeah, I measure it every time, don't you?
Yeah, in metric, yeah. Because it's so much easier.
Yeah, I think my personal best is probably, in a day, did we say?
Yeah, how much do you think the average person makes in a day?
I'm going to guess about 2 liters.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Whoa. You make like about a half liter.
Oh, well, I must be doing something wrong. Yeah, that guess. Or I have no idea what a liter actually looks like.
How much is normal? Oh, a half liter. How much do you pee? 2 liters.
Whoa. You're peeing 2 liters a day? Yeah, why?
I mean, look, we laugh. There are probably people who do pee that much because maybe they ingest that much fluid. But the average person is peeing, or is generating about 16 ounces or, you know, one Patriot pint of liquid a day.
I think it's also a sign of some diseases, right? Like prostate problems, yes, or diabetes or something, too.
Yeah, so if exactly. You end up peeing a lot.
More than, I guess, the standard now being half a liter.
Yeah, about a half a liter, 16 to 24 ounces is typically what they say. And the bladder, fills up typically and it stretches. It's not always big enough to hold all of that. And that's why you start to feel the need to pee. At about a quarter full, the bladder starts to send signals to the brain. So it's not even close to full.
You talk about your brain being like hardwired in a weird way. When you said the need to pee, I had a flashback to Top Gun when Tom Cruise is like, I feel the need. The need to pee.
Well, we've got some weird brains on this podcast. So I'll give us that.
This is the second Tom Cruise movie I brought up this podcast.
So if you get a quarter full, your brain gets a little notification, if you will, from the bladder that's like, hey, we're about a quarter, just so you know. It doesn't necessarily even trigger you consciously knowing that you have to pee, which I think is interesting. But about half full, it definitely is triggering your brain and telling you, okay, you gotta pee. And what's doing that is there are these stretch sensors on the outside of the bladder or in the inside of the bladder. I don't know.
If I put my hand down your throat.
If I put inside of the bladder, what is the outs? Anyway. They are within the bladder structure, and they can tell the brain, you know, how stretched it is. And so what ends up happening is at about half full, they start to get more urgent. And the sphincters that are holding your pee inside of your body are, you know, holding nice and tight. And so they want to, of course, let the pee out, and your brain has to decide to leave it in. And just in case there are some people who'd never learned sphincter as a term outside of the playground, sphincter is not just there is one really big one that everyone loves to talk about, but there are way more sphincters in the body than one.
Yeah, your stomach, right? You've got like sphincters before and after. It's any sort of like closing aperture dealing.
It's a muscle that looks like calamari. Whoop whoop whoop, just closing it right up. You know. How many sphincters do you think are in the body? Just fun fact.
2 liters.
Depending on their size, maybe volume. I don't know.
How many sphincters? 16.
50.
Holy smokes.
Right?
We have an 50. Embarrassment of sphincters.
I thought that was like 6.
You're
or something, you know?
Absolute bag of sphincters, Trace.
We are a bag
so
of sphincters. That's exactly what we are. So there's a lot in the GI tract. There's some, all the blood vessels, like to get to the capillaries, they have to have sphincters to control blood flow. If they don't, you get like edemas and stuff. So that's why they're there. And they're the eyes, the pupil, iris or whatever, the iris, not the pupil, is a sphincter.
Oh, it's like a light sphincter.
Yeah, it's
photon
a light sphincter.
Blocking sphincter.
Yeah. So Either way, the sphincter muscle keeps that bladder bag all locked up until the brain gives that go, no go for launch. So the exit ramp for urine, no gift shop, they just let it right out, flows out into whatever it is that you're catching it in. So the interesting thing here is that brain-bladder connection. So to pee, the autonomic nervous system, the somatic nervous system, and the brain all have to work together. Mm. So in a normal situation, the brain gets signals from those stretch receptors, the bladder's filling up, and they go through the sacral spinal nerves 2, 3, and 4, which if you think of the spinal column, at the very, very bottom is the little tailbone. Around the pelvis, a little above the tailbone, there are these holes, literally holes in your spine where these nerves kind of run into the spinal column and then head up toward the head. Mm-hmm. So these 2, 3, and 4, S2, 3, and 4 are what speak between the part of the body that is around the bladder, so the genitalia and like the leg, the upper thighs and things, the butt, the sphincters, the anus, all of that goes through 2, 3, and 4. And so the signal goes up the spine to the brain and it says, hey, we're, you know, half full. We should probably do something about that. And the brain's like, we're going to hold on to it for a bit. Just, you know, a little Braveheart moment. Hold.
See if we can make it till the traffic clears up.
Exactly. Yeah. And the sensory cortex receives it, determines if it's a lot of stretch or not. It's not always conscious of this again, like I said. And some of the brain sometimes would trigger that decision to hold on to it. And this holding is controlled by the micturition inhibitory center, which is in the frontal lobe where you'd end up with thinking, judgment, and self-control, which I think is really interesting because those are parts of the brain that evolved later. So if the if there's a no-go, we hold on to that, and the brain sends a signal back down. Now, I didn't know this because, I don't know, I don't remember it from biology class, but nerves only go one way. Did you know that? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that makes sense, right?
Yeah. It's a one-way travel. So there's 31 pairs of nerves in the spinal column, and so the S234 sends it up, and then a different pair of the S234 comes back down. Mm-hmm. And so they're only really going one way. The up is sort of near the middle of the spinal cord and the down is sort of around the back and around the sides, which is pretty cool. Hmm. Anyway, neither here nor there.
That is just cool. Neat. I like that.
Yeah. So if the brain says hold, then it holds. And if the decision is made for a go for launch, this is when the whole kind of dance starts. We have a parasympathetic collagenic nerve fiber that you can't control. This is part of the parasympathetic nervous system. So it just kind of happens, which is smooth muscles in the bladder will squeeze.
Yeah.
And they're squeezing to push the pee out. Then the alpha sympathetic nerve fiber lets the sphincters relax and lets the waste flow out. Again, you're not really controlling that. What you are controlling are voluntary muscles through the motor cortex. Your brain's like, okay, and coordinate, you know, synchronize your watches or whatever, and they send signals to striated muscles in the external sphincter and the pelvic floor. And that's where you can push or let things come out. And then you get that.
This is why newborn babies just pee at really inopportune moments, right?
Right.
Because they don't have that ability yet to, like, know or go or no go. And so the smooth muscle tissue that, like you said, is automatic, just works on its own, just like releases and sometimes to hilarious viral video effect.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like the brain is still a baby brain and the bladder's all like, hey, we're about a quarter full. We're about a half full. And the brain's like, cool, go for it, man. Mm-hmm. And the bladder's just like, woo!
And it's tinkle
done.
Time.
Yeah, it's always tinkle time. The brain, you know, hasn't really learned boundaries yet. So, it doesn't know to say no. It's fine. It's learning those boundaries and gets those eventually. So those stretch sensors, this without getting too dirty in case there are kids around, the stretch sensors relaxing for many people feels really good. Our brain rewards us for releasing waste, because if you don't, Julian, what happens to Tycho Brahe?
Tycho Brahe, the astronomer, famously drank too much wine at a dinner party and would not excuse himself because it would be bad table manners in like the, what, 1500s, late 1500s?
Yeah.
And his bladder exploded and then he died of an infection.
Right. So definitely don't hold on to your pee for too long. There are a variety of reasons why not to do it, but that being one. And, you know, Tycho is an interesting fella, no matter what. But I
character.
Knew that you would remember that from that video you made about him. Because you were like, he's such an interesting
total
guy.
Total madman.
Anyway, So we get a reward for releasing waste. Our brain rewards us, you know, with dopamine or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so the bladder also, remember, is through the S234, which are the same as all the other parts in the area. So if you think about where the bladder is relative to the other things in the area, some people really like the feeling of a full bladder. They really like the feeling of evacuating their bladder. There are reasons for that, and it's because all of these things are interwired. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the bladder already has a lot of these connections right there. So, since the teeth floating isn't exactly a problem, most of the stuff I just described we know about because there was a problem, right? Mm. Something was broken, somebody wasn't going to the bathroom when they wanted, or they wanted to and they couldn't, so medicine would study, okay, where is the break? Where is something that's not working like you want? And they would spend all this time to figure it out. But teeth floating isn't exactly a problem. So as Spencer said, we don't know that much about it. And that's probably because it's not bad. However, I did find a dentist on a forum who would weigh in on the back teeth thing. And he wrote, quote, "Your question is interesting because during my 42 years as a dentist, I have heard it before. 2 to 3 patients asked me why they get a tingling sensation in their gums when they need to go to the bathroom for one reason or another. So all I can say is you're obviously not alone, but I have not found any research about it on the subject and I don't want to guess. But we do know that the nervous system is complicated and there may be a connection between both ends of the alimentary canal. Perhaps this would be something worth studying." So, all of that aside, I sat down and said, "I'm not a dentist. Of course I can guess."
You would have really worried me if you said, "I might as well be a dentist." That was your starting point.
So I spent the weekend learning dentistry.
Amateur dentist and hobbyist brain surgeon, Trace Dominguez.
Hello, everybody.
Oh, Dr. Nick. Second Simpsons reference this episode.
Yeah. R.I.P.
Somebody's going to have a reference bingo at some point.
Okay. I hope so. Somebody has to keep track. So I sat around and I thought about it. Julian, when you look at the sun, do you sneeze?
I mean, I don't make a habit of it, but I have heard it. For me, no, it doesn't happen. But I do know many people who say in bright sunlight, they start sneezing.
Yep. It's called the autosomal dominant compelling haloophthalmic outburst syndrome.
Expialidocious. Even
if you wrote that out, you would get A-C-H-O-O.
Achoo
syndrome.
Oh, the acronyms strike again.
It's so good. And so solar sneezes are a response that occurs with exposure to bright light. Basically, the reason it happens, they think, is because of crossed wires. The nerves in your face get excited by this bright light, and the fifth cranial nerve or trigeminal nerve, specifically, they kind of interact, they crosstalk inside of your body, and you sneeze. And 15 to 30% of humans do this. It's likely genetically inherited. It's more common in white people and in people assigned female at birth. But does that sound like something we've been talking about, right? This is what I came up with, is maybe there's crosstalk with the nerves in your body. So when you really have to pee, the nerves in your body are going, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And your brain is saying, hold. And all of that activity is going in between nerves in your face to give you this tingling sensation in the back of your mouth. So I went and I looked up, and there are several nerves all in your face that are connected very closely to other places, similarly closely to these two nerves that we know cause this achoo syndrome.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. What? So are you going to tell me the names of these nerves?
Yeah, the mandibular nerve V3 is the lower jaw, and the mandibular nerve V2 is the upper jaw. So maybe, I don't know because he didn't say, but perhaps they only feel it in their lower jaw or upper jaw. If that's the case, it would help us kind of narrow it down. But on top of that, the face is like a tangled anatomical map of nerves. There are so many nerves running through there. There's some really good interactive anatomy things you can look at online and just turn off everything that's not a nerve. And there are just nerves running everywhere through your jaw and through your face. And they're connected right to the brain. And some of them run parallel to the vagus nerve and the parasympathetic nerves, which we know are being activated. So really interesting. I came up with my own acronym. You
yes,
ready?
That's what I was going to ask. Okay, good, good. I want to know. I want to hear.
Okay, so this one, it was the first one I came up with. I don't love it.
Okay.
It's the PODAG, paresthesia of dentition and gingiva, which is Paresthesia means like tingly, and then dentition and gingiva are gums and teeth. So then I kept thinking about it for a while, and you're gonna hate this. You ready?
Oh, I can't wait! I'm gonna love how much I hate it.
Gingiva or dentition, acute paresthesia excitation experience, which is gotta pee.
Perfect, perfect. I was gonna go with paresthesia electroneural excitation,
ooh,
which would just be pee.
That's nice.
Yeah.
So yeah, we
but
can
like
we can come.
I like the gotta pee. I like the gotta
yeah.
pee. Yeah.
So G-O-D-A is gingiva or dentition acute. Mm-hmm. So it's really gingiva or dentition acute and then paresthesia excitation, which I like yours better. What did you say?
I think it was like electroneuronal excitation.
Electroneural, that's nice. Yeah, electroneural excitation is nice. And also if you want to be a little boy about it, then it would be peen, which
peen,
is pretty funny.
Which I also thought... I did consider that. I'm not going to lie, but I wasn't going to say it.
So maybe if there are enough people studying why we sneeze when we look at the sun, maybe we should get some people to study gotta pee syndrome.
I can see the late night commercial now. Like, you suffer from gotta pee? Ask your doctor
to study it.
To look into that for us.
Yeah, so you don't have to ask your doctor about medicine. You have to
podcast.
Ask your doctor to go do some research.
Do us a solid. We make a podcast that's listened to by literally tens of people. And we need to know.
So my answer for Spencer is no one knows why this happens. More research is needed. My YouTube channel is leaking. I'm sorry. And then you can't... you could actually be that research. We know that it happens to you. Let's find some experts who will study you,
Spencer,
or people like you, Spencer.
Donate yourself to science. Surrender yourself to the nearest science fortress for examination forthwith. And if there is time travel involved, do not bring a chicken.
Do not
please.
Bring a chicken.
Please leave chickens
please
behind.
Do not bring a chicken. We have a bin out front for any chickens that you accidentally brought.
We have a take a chicken, leave a chicken.
Like at the airport, when you have a water bottle that you accidentally left water in, they have a spot for that. There's a chicken there.
When you're going back in time, just leave it in the chicken bin. Oh my goodness, this is so good.
So that's my answer for why do my teeth feel like they're floating. Maybe crosstalk and nerves, I don't know.
Crosstalk and nerves or something, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
That's so good. That's so good. I love that.
Wow.
I hope so. I wasn't going to reveal this. I did not tell you this when you picked this question. Spencer's my cousin. Yeah.
What?
We did,
Spencer!
I did not advocate for this question to be picked. Honestly, I love picking as many like random listener questions from as many people that we have no affiliation with whatsoever. But would you pick this one? Because as a matter of fact, right after the podcast started, I saw him. He was in town. We got dinner and he's like, I got a question for you. My back teeth feel like they're floating. What's up with that, right? And
that is that
was
what
like,
Spencer sounds
that was
like?
Yeah, exactly. That was 10 months ago. It's like he's here. That was 10 months ago. My mom saw him recently, and she was like, oh, Spencer likes your podcast, but he wants to know what's up with his back teeth feeling like they're floating. And I was like, he's still concerned about that?
He must be. Firstly, Spencer, stop holding your pee so much. Go to the bathroom.
You have a problem.
You have to. It's
Cousin
not good
Spencer.
To hold on to it. That's how you get kidney stones. And if you have a lot of minerality in your urine, it can cause. There are a lot of problems. You got to go to the bathroom when you first feel like you have to go. Go.
I'm really glad you addressed this before this became like a running thing for years. Where every time
in
I
your
go
family,
to a family,
I
kind of
wish I hadn't now just to torture you. I wish I would have known.
Spencer being like, hey man, got a great question for your pod. Oh, is it the back teeth thing, Spencer? Is it that again? Oh my god. I'm gonna start calling him P Dispenser. That's gonna be his.
What?
He's a great guy and a very talented sculptor. So thank you for your question,
cool.
Spencer.
Thank you for your question, Spencer, and also your question, Itai. This was a very biology-heavy episode, so I hope y'all enjoyed it.
Yeah, we normally try and mix up the topics, but I loved the time travel dinosaur one and the it being cold season so much, I had to go for it.
Oh yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of That's Absurd. Please elaborate, everyone. This show was created, written, and produced by me, Trace Dominguez,
and me, Julian Huguet.
And it was produced and edited by the wonderful and wonderfully talented Kyle Sisk.
Special thanks to listeners who submitted the questions featured on this episode, Spencer and Nitai. If you'd like to submit a question, you can look for the form in our show notes, or you can email us at hello@thatsabsurdshow.com. We've also got that website, thatsabsurdshow.com/ask, and keep sending those in. The show wouldn't be possible without these zany, ridiculous, fun questions, so keep them coming. And sharing them with us.
We honestly could not do the podcast without it. And even if we just asked each other questions, they aren't as good as the weird ones that you send in.
So
please
not.
Continue sending them in. We've got a big database of questions, and I super love them. Mm-hmm. Finally, also a special thanks to those who are listening over on Nebula. Thank you for that. You get access to ad-free versions of episodes and even can support the show just by listening over on Nebula. So if you do want to join nebula.tv/thatsabsurdshow. And remember, leave your chickens in the chicken bin.